A5. Number 3B.
Alright. So, Mrs. Eddy took the Bible, which has already presented God as life and truth and love and spirit, and said, but this must be a divine principle. And she built her revelation on the divine principle. And so she introduced in her first exposition of Christian Science the term principle for God next to the biblical terms of spirit, life, truth, and love. And also, she introduced right away a new synonymous term for God, namely soul. And this is quite interesting to see that. Why? Because in her revelation, she began to see that there is only one being. And because there is only one being, there must be complete identity between that one being and its creation. That there is not a creator and somewhere else a creation, but that creator and creation is identical, has identity of nature, and that she expressed with soul, because soul is the term for the idea identity, and identity means reality at the deepest level where subject and object is one. She began to see there is not a subject called God, a thinking subject, a divine subject called God, and then its object as man and the universe, but that they are one and the same thing, only in regard to cause and effect, they are different. And so she introduced the term soul, because soul would say there is only one soul. Not each man has a soul by himself. There is only one soul, therefore there is one great identity called God. And there is not a central principle, and then split away from that central principle all the things that are going on somewhere in the universe. But that principle is the center and circumference of the whole. And therefore everything within the whole is identical with its principle. And to express that identity with its principle, she used the term soul. Her first edition is full of the synonymous term soul, much more than the present one. She used soul much more than in the last edition, because that was the point of her revelation, to see, my God, really, there is not somewhere a God and somewhere God's creation. There where God is its creation, and there where creation is God. There is absolute identity in time and space and in every way and in quality. Where is God, there is creation. Where there is creation, there is God. You cannot split them up into two. Then, at that time, the synonymous term mind was still missing in her works. She hadn't capitalized mind yet. Even in the first edition, we don't find mind capitalized, but we find various ideas of mind capitalized, like wisdom, like intelligence, creator, and so on. And then you can see how she got into trouble. She got into trouble because she didn't capitalize mind. Therefore, when she was speaking about mind, and when she meant the divine mind with mind, and not the human mind, the reader just meant mind, because that's how it was written, mind. And so for the reader it could be his mind, and not the divine mind. And therefore he was practicing his mind, the student, and was becoming a very good practitioner in mesmerism instead of in metaphysics. And that was that time where she had to take up the whole question of animal magnetism, of malpractice, etc. And you know that actually the first edition only came out when she had written those few pages on animal magnetism, on malpractice first, and only then the printer would go on printing the first edition. But even in the second edition, she didn't, in the chapter on animal magnetism, she didn't capitalize mind and got further into trouble. And only with the third edition, she began to capitalize mind in the chapter on animal magnetism. And that broke the mesmerism, actually, then. And from then on, she began to see clear. So you can see that term which we use most today, namely mind, was the last synonymous term that she capitalized. We know that she was telling in 1888 her class, one of the last classes she held, she was telling the students that it took her quite a while to find the synonymous terms. That first she didn't know how to define God, and that she had to wait always until the next synonymous term was revealed to her, and then she would take that up, and only then, step by step, all the synonymous terms were revealed. And she said those synonymous terms were revealed when she began to know that God knows himself. That's very typical, huh? See, only when she began to see that God knows himself, she began to see that she could detect or could define God through the seventh synonymous term. Can you see what I said before as a scientist? The moment she left the attempt to define God again, like the philosophers and other religionists have done, from the human system of reference, to define from the human system of reference the divine, when she gave up that and began to see, oh no, it's different. God knows himself. Because God knows himself, I can know God. Therefore, God can reveal himself to me. That she began to see the synonymous terms, step by step, until finally she had them. And when she had them in that class, as you know, she said that upon the truth of these terms for God rests the basis of the science. In fact, they are the science. She said, now I have found the basis of science. In other words, we can build a whole science on those seven synonymous terms. That's terrific. Just as you can build a whole science of music just on the tones of the seven tones. Or you can build a whole science of arithmetic just on the 10 digits. You have so few, and you can build a terrific structure of science on that few. If those fundamental elements are clearly recognized, if one sees their true place values, their orders, and then it just begins to flow and flow and flow, and there seems to be no end to it anymore. So this is what we are engaged in and to investigate. And if we look back now historically, and I want to do that, we can perhaps best realize how the seven synonymous terms evolved. So what I want to do now is to just relate in a chatty way, say how the insight into the seventh synonymous term evolved through the last 40 years or so. And I like to tell you that because there are no more many left here who have gone through that whole historical period. You know that it started, so to say, with John Dorley in the 30s, and I was involved in it right from the beginning, so I have next to Peggy Brook and practically we are the only ones more or less left. We have a first-hand experience, the insight of what happened from year to year. And I always feel if one knows the story of something, it's of greatest value, because then one knows how something has unfolded step by step, what difficulty one had in that unfoldment, what mistakes one was making in thinking along that unfoldment, so that one is no more falling back to the same mistakes if one doesn't know that whole unfoldment. So, if you don't mind, I just chat to you about the unfoldment of those seven synonymous terms. And I think we understand best that whole development, which is each one's development, only that it doesn't need to take 40 years, as it has taken me, but that you can do it in a much shorter way once the pioneer has broken up the wilderness and has paved the way. Then you can take the Rolls Royce. No, you take another one and drive through it. Yes. Now, I think to understand what happened and what happens to each one of us, I think I first go quickly back to what I was presenting about 2 years ago in 1973, when I was telling you about Kuhn's book on the structure of scientific revolution. Because this is fundamental to every scientific revolution, just as the story I am telling you about the investigation of the seven synonymous terms. Kuhn, who is a professor at the MIT and has written that terrific book, which is quoted since, he has written it all over the place. Whenever I take up a scientific book about any subject, whatever that subject is, I can be quite sure that they are quoting Kuhn and referring back to Kuhn. And it is a story that is so vivid within each one of us. And I want to bring that story to life in each one of you, that you see what's going on within the consciousness. He presents the general structure of a scientific revolution, and I just quickly recapitulate his steps and says something like this. He says a paradigm is a set of rules, laws, principles, which are accepted within a science which is now normal, and so calls it normal science. So any science that is established on an acknowledged paradigm is called normal science. Then, when this science is practiced over and over and over and over, there suddenly appears perhaps a phenomena that does not fit into that accepted paradigm, that is therefore not resolvable within normal science. Usually that new phenomena, which he calls an anomaly, is swept under the carpet and says, this is humbug, we don't want to have anything to do with it. So normal science is very traditional, orthodox, unable to think in new lines. But these anomalies always pop up from time to time. And those who give heed to the anomaly and investigate the anomaly and find perhaps a reason and a logic in it, and find a solution, they are outsiders, dissenters, and they have to formulate a new paradigm. They have to approach that whole question from a new angle, with a new frame of thought, so to say, with a new model of thought, and so establish a new paradigm, and the science that is established on that new paradigm he calls extraordinary science. Extraordinary science. When this extraordinary science has success, it takes over slowly, 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 and becomes finally again normal science. It is accepted by everybody. After 20 years, 30 years, it's accepted, and so extraordinary science becomes again normal science. He goes a step further and says, but as this happens from time to time, therefore, those who are willing to accept the anomaly at once and are willing always to go and investigate the anomaly and be ready to investigate a new paradigm and therefore be a founder of extraordinary science, if they do that as a general attitude over and over, then they are actually mature scientists. And he calls them mature science. Mature science is therefore that scientist who is willing to question normal science and its paradigm constantly, who is willing to investigate anomalies and new paradigms constantly, and is willing to change. And that is mature science. Now, this is the general principle, and I'll show you afterwards where we fit into that picture, where each one fits into it. Mrs. Eddy was brought up in the ordinary church, in the old paradigm, in the accepted paradigm of, let's say, normal science. When she had her revelation, she certainly was bringing out a new paradigm. An anomaly happened. She was healed not on a medical basis, but on a spiritual basis. So an anomaly happened. And she was, and this again makes her a scientist and not really a religious mystic, that she was not satisfied with that phenomena of being suddenly healed spiritually, but that she said, I must know the signs of this healing. Now, can you see, here is a Mrs. Eddy, not as a religionist, but as a scientist, saying here is an anomaly, I don't sweep it under the carpet as just something extraordinary and it doesn't really fit into the general pattern of old religion. I go and investigate it until I find a new paradigm, and then when I find a new paradigm, I can build a new science, extraordinary science on it. Because what happened to Mrs. Eddy isn't so extraordinary at all. That has happened to thousands of Christian mystics, Christian saints that afterwards have been sainted by the Pope and so on. That such extraordinary healings all through the century, especially all through the Middle Ages, have happened over and over and over. If we read the history of religion, we have them by the thousands. So the mere phenomena wasn't extraordinary, so to say. But all the others that had that extraordinary phenomena, they remained normal scientists. They went right back to the old and said, this is a marvel, this is something extraordinary, but extraordinary. Whereas Mrs. Eddy said, this should be normal. This should not be extraordinary. This should be a normal thing. This should be a law, and the law is normal. See, all the other saints, in quotes, they went right back to the old. They were not thinking there must be a new paradigm. That's what makes Mrs. Eddy not a saint in the old churchy sense, Christian sense, but a scientist. Yes? Do you see that? Huh? Makes her a scientist. Asking a new question, a heretical question. You say heretical? Yes. A real heretical question she was asking. Said, this must be understood. There must be a science about it. God must be able to be explained. That it's explainable. All right. So she began to find a new paradigm. She found the definition of God. She presented the extraordinary science as Christian science and taught it as extraordinary science and attracted people who also in some way were willing to get away from the ordinary church into the extraordinary church. Those people, all who left the old church and went to the new, they went through that revolution of going away from normal science, being attracted by the new paradigm, and therefore learning that new paradigm and becoming a Christian scientist, which therefore would be extraordinary science. And so all these people who have been once in another church and brought up in another church and came to Christian science seem to value Christian science perhaps much more than those who were born, so to say, in Christian science and have taken it as something very natural, because they have had to make that transition, that inward translation and reformation, which with a lot of struggle and with a lot of thinking and with a lot of doings and so on, and can value therefore extraordinary science, or Christian science in this case, much more. So there came a period where for hundreds of thousands extraordinary science, namely Christian science, became slowly over 10 and 20 and 30 and 40 and 60 years normal, and it became normal science to be in the church, to be in Christian science. Was accepted normal. And finally, you had again in Christian science, for the field of Christian scientists, it became normal science with an accepted paradigm. And you could write about that paradigm, you could write in the journal about the paradigm, in the Sentinel, you could lecture about the paradigm, you could teach about that paradigm, but only the paradigm that was accepted in normal science. Christian scientists have made once the transition from normal science to extraordinary science and felt that's that. So they had not taken the attitude of a mature scientist. Because a mature scientist is that, as we have seen, who when he has accepted the new paradigm and has practiced the new paradigm, he still is looking out for something that is an anomaly, and is looking out for a new paradigm, and again an extraordinary science. So those who do that are very few. Many are called, but few are chosen. That's a statement in the Bible that is so true for each one of us. And each one of us has the choice to say, to which category do I belong? To those who are called or to those who are chosen? Those who are called are those who are what they are. Those who are chosen are those who choose themselves, who choose themselves to be extraordinary scientists, mature scientists, who always have that inquiring mind, that new inquiring mind which says, is there something more about that whole subject? Isn't there another approach to it? Isn't there another approach that may be much more direct? So one of those who had that questioning attitude was John Dorley. He questioned the paradigm of the church very early in his life. Way back into the First World War period, that he began to question, is it right that we call ourselves scientists if we don't know the science of it? If we don't know really what is the system of this science. And in order to know the system, I have to know the categories of this system. And in order to know the categories of the system, I must know how to categorize the infinite phenomena at all. And when I have categories, in order to be a system, I must know how categories blend with each other. All these questions that have to do with science, he was asking, which were at his time heretical. You were not allowed to ask these questions. At his time, it was quite enough if you said that being is one and there is only one being. But to ask, what are the orders in that one being? What are the laws ruling in that one being? Was not allowed and could not be answered at his time. So here begins the story of the seven synonymous terms. Because in his inquest into the question, what is science, he logically went out from the great question, what is God? And to try to see from that one principle of the oneness of being, to find a way of deduction, of absolute clear deduction, to find the answer to the whole of being. So I want to tell you that story this afternoon. Yes.